Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast. My name is Charles Lowell. I'm a software developer here at the Frontside and your podcast host in training. With me today is Elric Ryan. Hello, Elric.
Hey, what's up, Charles?
Not much. You enjoying your morning so far?
Yeah, my morning is going well.
Yeah,
everything is good. It's going smooth.
Lots of cups of coffee?
No cups of coffee yet. Okay. Green tea. I've been drinking lots of green tea.
Okay. I've actually heard that's really good for you.
That's what I heard too. That's why I started drinking it.
But does it taste like, did you continue because it tastes good, or just like, do you just live on the idea of how good it is for you?
A little bit of both. I mean, it doesn't taste that great, but it's not horrible. It's almost like an acquired taste. Okay. And then when you add in that, hey, this is good for me, then it tastes great.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's like a nice altered perception there.
Yes.
So anyway, you know, I guess we should at some point get on to the main content of our podcast. We have a very interesting guest with us today who has her fingers in all kinds of pies that we were talking about just at the pre-show, just before we were recording. And so we're really, really happy to have Kaylee Kwan. Thank you for coming on the show and welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's going to be great. Now, you are a software engineer at Eventbrite. That's correct?
Yep.
What kind of things do you do over there?
So I used to work on part of the feature team that worked on our reserve seating product, but not too long ago, I moved to our front-end platform team, which is the team that helps other front-end engineers move faster through things like working on infrastructure, our Eventbrite design system, and dev tools.
So like getting into the tools that like unlock the exponential productivity of the developer team.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to dig into all that, because you just listed a bunch of really interesting stuff. I'm really excited to talk about the design systems in particular, but lots of different stuff. But before we do, I understand that you have a fairly unique way of entering in to the position that you're in now. Like your journey didn't follow the traditional arc. Would you be willing to elaborate on that or tell us that story?
Yeah, totally. So I graduated with a degree in art history, not related to computer science at all. And then right after, I moved to New York and worked for a small startup. And I was doing sort of like marketing / business development role. And I wasn't really happy with it. I was working on some designy stuff on the side with HTML and CSS, but I just felt like my brain just needed to be stimulated a little more. So I applied to this all-women's bootcamp program called Hackbright in San Francisco. And it was a 3-month intensive program. And luckily, coming out of that, I had at least some initial knowledge to get my foot in the door. And Eventbrite was one of the hiring partners. So they brought me in for an interview. I actually had no idea that it was going to be a front-end engineering role because my bootcamp was totally in Python and it just had more like a back-end focus. And Ben, who spoke at React Boston conference with me, was actually one of the interviewers. And he gave me this closure problem and I solved it, but in Python, just using recursion. And he was like, okay, you got it. So just convert it to JavaScript. And I was like, no, it just can't be done. I don't know JavaScript. But for some reason, they chose to hire me. And then they kind of onboarded me as kind of like an internal bootcamp within Eventbrite. So the first 3 months I was there, I learned about React, Redux, JavaScript, ES6, all of that good stuff. And then they moved me to a feature team where I continued, working on the product. And then I then became involved more with open source projects. And I really expressed interest in, hey, like when you're a new engineer coming on board, there's all these like assumed knowledge that, you know, isn't documented anywhere, or something will be really obscure and hard to use, but people will just kind of assume that that's the status quo. And this idea around developer experience and helping other developers move faster was just kind of become a natural interest of mine. So I was talking to the platform team, Ben in particular, and expressed my interest in working in these areas. So just about like a month ago, we did sort of like a big reorg and I landed on the platform team. And currently we have like a lot of projects in flight, one of them being moving our dependency system from our old code base, which was written in require.js to Webpack. Mm-hmm. we're building out our Eventbrite design system, which is basically a shared UI component library that other teams could leverage. So our platform team will just come in and make sure that the API is usable across different teams and maintain like a consistent brand in terms of look and feel. Mm-hmm. And we're also working on other tooling stuff, like making sure we use Docker for our dev environment. So making sure that the front end containers don't break, making sure that everyone is on the same version of ESLint, Node, things like that.
So how do you make sure that the front end containers don't break?
It's actually hard. So I think one thing that we're trying to test right now is using Yarn's like offline mirror and having better caching. So when you build the containers, that it'll look into the cache directory, which is just a bunch of like committed tarballs. And that way they don't have to fetch to the network each time, because once the log file or package.json changes at our current state, it'll rebuild the entire container and it could take a very long time. We just have a lot of packages that we've added over time. Yeah, other things, we're experimenting along with our platform team on the backend side about having remote images. So instead of devs building their containers locally on their computer, having them remotely built by a CI system and them just pulling the container and the images down.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So really, really, you're like all over the place. That sounds like so much fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of context switching. Sorry if that was like jumping too many topics at once.
No, absolutely not. I think it's actually fascinating and to actually capture the kind of scope, because when you are doing development, if you yourself are not running up and down the stack, the tools that you use are. And so, the better the tools, the better you're able to focus on the one little sliver of the stack that you're working on. So, right, if I don't have to worry about, where my Docker images are coming from, or where, if there's a temporary network blip that I can't install my dependencies, if I don't have to worry about those things, then that makes me more effective. And so it's important to say that, or to just kind of lay out all the stuff that goes into making a quality developer experience.
Yeah, the dream is like front end people wouldn't have to worry about any of like the back end stuff, and they just have this isolated environment where they could just work on what they do best, which is JavaScript and writing features in React, and everything else just works. And they could see that replicated through their dev environment as well as QA and prod, and hopefully make every like tooling that they use, like testing and linting, all easily intuitive and accessible.
So how is it that you're working up and down the stack? You're working with, making sure that your CI systems build your Docker images, but then also at the same time working on, a design system, which involves, so you've got collaboration, I assume, with some pretty hardcore like DevOps teams, but also then you're interfacing with designers to kind of flesh out, your design system. Are those the same people on the platform team, or is that, are there different groups within it?
Yes. So we have designers and UX researchers actually part of our engineering unit. So we work pretty closely with them to define guidelines on what the design system should look like, because coming into making this design system, one thing we really wanted to make sure that is that both sides, engineering and design, have input, rather than we had like a previous old version called Style Guide, which it was more engineering driven than not. So, one team would need a modal, so they would build a modal, and then a different team would build the like a slightly different modal, and we would end up with like five different modals, and right. They wouldn't be maintained over time. And there wasn't really a focus on accessibility or consistency of brand. So the new design system project was to sort of eliminate all of those pain points.
Right. Right. And so what goes in for people who may not be familiar with a design system, but it's something that certainly is like cropping up more and more. What's the general strategy you take? Clearly you've talked about like the kind of the pains that it solves. So like I'm experiencing this pain where I've got, I've got five dialogues. I've got, three ways of laying out forms. I've got these problems. What's the strategy that I go about as my organization for trying to implement this? Like, gosh, okay, now I want to do a design system. Where do I start?
one big thing I think that helped us was developing Eventbrite Design System as just sort of the standalone product. So you could run Eventbrite Design System as a standalone with all of the documentation and components, with each of their like different props that could be configured, and it has its own set of tests. And all of the components are API driven. So there's nothing specific about business logic that it assumes. So for example, our button component just assumes that it'll be receiving a type of submission and some children body. And it doesn't make any assumptions that it's going to be anything Eventbrite specific. It's just however configurable the end user wants it to be. Another thing that helped is we have a planned approach session right before we start working on a new component. So a developer who would be building the component would meet with one of the front-end platform members, and we'll be discussing the API of the component, the CSS that would go in it, and the designer would do the final QA. So the development takes longer than if you were to write just a component for your app, but we're trying to build it out for a long-term use. And we have versioning for Eventbrite Design System as a library. So, you know, whenever you make updates, we add it to the changelog and then it gets released and we bump it in core, which is where all of our apps live, and people have to get the new version. And basically it's like an orchestrated effort, and we have a process built around scheduled releases and bumping it in core.
I get the wanting to have a uniform, you know, buttons, uniform, you know, labels, dialogues, things like that. So how do you attack the problem of higher level workflows, like a form submission and validation process that might have a lot of different pathways? Like, how do you guide that using a design system?
Those are actually really good questions, because we've went through issues like that. We've like validation form field or components that have logic around just more of complex inputs, and validation is really hard because different teams use it like in a slightly different way. So we ended up having two versions of text inputs, and now we're in the process of deprecating the V1 and then having people move over to V2. And we also use the atomic design principle for Eventbrite Design System. So it means things like atoms would be composed of buttons. And then we have molecules, which are slightly more complex. And then one level above that would be organisms, which are things like forms. And obviously, as you move up to like the higher level, it becomes more difficult for us to decide, does this belong in EDS or does it belong with the app? So there's like lots of refactoring that sometimes ends up happening as a result of something built one way and us realizing later down the road that, oh, it wasn't actually very extensible. We just built it for this particular use case. Or sometimes it's the opposite, where this was too generic. We can make it a little bit more specific and add more logic to it. So it really depends on the component, but that's been our strategy, just sort of tweaking the components as needed. I mean, we're still in the earlier stages. Like, we've released EDS like a year ago, and now we're almost close to finishing it. We were just like missing just a handful of components. So there'd be more tweaking that's available as opposed to adding a brand new component.
Did you find guidance in existing design systems? Like, you know, one thing is, you know, why not just use one of the existing ones that's out there? Is it a matter of branding? Is it a matter of just, hey, there are certain interactions which are unique to our product that we need a design system to capture them? Or is it, you know, like, I guess my question is what help, if this is something that I wanted to take on myself, what tools would I be able to reach for? And, you know, what other design systems would I be able to look to versus what I have to contribute myself? Like, what am I going to be looking for to share with the community? And what am I going to look for that's like you develop that's uniquely mine?
Yeah, I think consistency was a big issue. Sort of the genesis of an idea came actually even before I joined the company. But I think what they were going for was that we already had like an existing component library called Style Guide, and it wasn't really working out for us. So to build like a common UI library was sort of a natural assumption, but making it better, making it more reusable. And, you know, we looked at companies like Airbnb and Microsoft and learned a lot from what they were doing. We definitely wanted some components that are specific to Eventbrite, such as like a ticket card or a media card that we use for our browse pages, which would be needed for Eventbrite specific pages. And I think mostly the designers wanted more control because, you know, relying on a third-party library means, you know, we don't always get what we want. And we're actually thinking about making EDS open source at some point in the future where it could take themes so other companies or individuals could leverage it, but use their own sort of theming scheme. So if Spotify came and wanted to use EDS, but using their colors and brand logo, then they could do so just by layering like a different configuration style to it.
That's such an interesting idea. Is this something that you all have explored? Maybe collaborating with another company, or is this? I mean, I'm trying to think what would be the benefit of making it publicly available, unless you would be getting, you know, lots of contributions back to improve EDS itself. Is that the idea?
Yeah. So we're like definitely set on making it public at some point in the future, but making it open source is a different conversation because, like you said, all of sort of the pros and cons that comes with open sourcing a package. So we recently open sourced Brightcharts, which is a D3 library, and it's great. It's been getting a lot of contributions. It's like a good recruiting tool, but it's also a lot of maintenance work outside of the developer's like normal work hours. And also then we have to start worrying about, when we make a breaking change to the component, we're not just breaking it for our own product, but other developers. And we currently have external developers. We have like an Eventbrite plugin system called Spectrum. So developers are already building on top of that. And they've been asking for something like this where they could leverage and sort of match the look and feel with the rest of the product. But yeah, the downside is lots of maintenance hours and worrying about you have to worry so much about all the people you would be breaking the component for by just solving your use case. I feel like I didn't fully answer one of your questions, which was you have like a different dynamic of people working on both like really back-endy opsy things as well as a really front-end design system work. We've definitely got very smart people on the team. Some people definitely have expertise in one area versus another. So currently we have 5 developers and some of us lean more towards the back end of the front end work. And I'm one of those people working on things like Yarn and some of our like Docker and build system work. Mm-hmm. But it's funny because like I was like thinking if I had a portfolio, then there wouldn't be any like visual components to it, even though I'm a front end developer. It would just be like terminal screens. Yeah, so we try to divide the work, but everyone tries to, I guess, develop, you know, at least some shared knowledge around like why we make the decisions that we do.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, you know, how they all intersect. I feel like, you know, kind of the trend of the last 10 years has been like to dev all the things. Like, so I think the first thing was there was this kind of artificial divide between, you know, developers and testing, right? And that kind of came together with like the test-driven development and, you know, the mm-hmm. kind of test-obsessed. Yep. And then, you know, there was this divide between development and ops, and that divide went away now with the advent of the DevOps movement. And then there's now this kind of been this divide between developers and design. And I feel like that kind of wall is collapsing right now. And you have developers participating a lot more in design and designers, you know, participating a lot more in development. And so we're kind of seeing that, but it's just funny how, you know, the dev, you know, starts integrating with all the things.
Yeah. That's a really good insight.
But, so you said you kind of naturally gravitate towards, you know, more of the back end doing the working with Docker, working with Yarn. How did you get actually, involved with, the Yarn project?
So Eventbrite converted over from NPM to Yarn maybe a year ago, and just the benefits that we got from converting over was awesome because, well, one thing, we were manually editing NPM shrink wrap, which was kind of a nightmare, and the installation speed of the containers was really slow just because we were on NPM 2 and it didn't really have any advanced like caching mechanisms at that point. And Yarn just sped up a lot of things for us. I really like the user interface. Outside of just installing, you actually get a lot of freebie commands like Yarn Y that tells you why you have a particular dependency.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, or you could do like Yarn Check. And it was just a lot more helpful. And I've been wanting to contribute to open source for a while. So I did a little bit of work before then, but the community was like really encouraging when I first tried to solve, like pick up some, you know, good first contribution bugs off of their backlog. And at the time they were pushing for a 1.0 release. So there's like a lot of excitement about, you know, what Yarn will be and all the new features we'll be adding. And yeah, I kept trying to, you know, pick at like places where I felt like I could be of help. And then Christoph, who's a manager of the Yarn team and believed the Jest team as well, reached out and asked if I wanted to build the selective resolution feature for them. And I was like, yeah, I'll give it a go. And then
So what is selective resolution?
Yes, good question.
Because I use Yarn every day and I've never heard this term.
Yeah, it's something that became available with the 1.0 release, much like workspaces. And most of the time, you're not going to need it. But sometimes you're using a library, and that library will have a nested dependency that for some reason has a bug, or you can't work with that package, or maybe you just want to dedupe the package so that all of your dependencies end up using one version of that particular nested package. So selective resolution is like a way for you to override other libraries' dependencies.
Ooh, that's really cool. No, I like that because I've had that happen to me where it's like, you know, I want some version of a library that's got a bug fix, and yet some other library that's like depending is requiring this library and they're getting the old version. And I'm like, nah!
That was happening to me last night.
Like, I'm kidding, you know, like.
I wish I knew about this.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah. yeah. I mean, like before
I'm
this.
I'm glad we had you on just to find out about this.
Awesome. Yeah, before this, like you would have to file an issue with like the original, you know, maintainer, and maybe it'll get fixed, maybe it won't, or maybe you're stuck on an old version and you can't do anything about it. Yeah, we had like a really similar issue with like the Phantom.js package, where we wanted to use like a next patch version with a bug fix, but then something that was requiring it wasn't letting us use it. So, I mean, it works. I verified it. Yeah, and it seems like Facebook started using it as well. So it was like pretty rewarding to work on that.
Well, that's exciting. I also plan on using it the next time I encounter this.
Yes.
So to get this feature, is this a flag that you have to pass? Or how does it do the selective resolution?
Yeah, so as long as you're using Yarn 1.0 or above, you define a resolutions field inside of your package.json.
Okay.
You know, like how you would define dev dependencies, you also have an extra field called resolutions. And on the left-hand side, you put in a glob pattern that you want to match.
Yep.
And if you want to match all packages, then you just enter the name of the package. And then on the right side, you enter whatever version or path that you want it to match. So it could be a file or a GitHub link, or it could be a version or a range, whatever you want.
Nice.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Now, you mentioned that as you were coming to work on this, you were looking for features to work on, but that the community actually did a very good job of drawing you in. And getting that contribution from you, which is actually, that's pretty amazing. When you think about it, I think a lot of open source projects either flourish or fail by their ability to attract contributors. What was it that was particularly inviting?
Yeah, it was a combination of things. I think one thing is they try to point you to the actual code, like, oh, if you wanted to submit a PR, then this is where you would get started. And I actually started doing that myself on some of the issues. You know, everyone loves PRs more than issues. So I think giving people filing the issues some, I guess, empowerment to try to fix it on their own, I think is great. They also have a Discord channel for devs to talk about any questions that they might have, how to set up their initial dev environment, to test things on Yarn. And also they were just really nice. They were really thankful when I, posted a PR or commented on a fix. They also used a lot of emojis, which helps. Yeah. And I think I personally found it really rewarding because it made me a better developer. Before contributing to Yarn, I didn't know that much about Node. For me, it was just fun to like learn more about like, oh, this is how something else works. And also the code base uses like a lot of different linting configurations, which I hadn't really used before. So that was a nice learning curve there as well.
So your initial time going into Yarn when you didn't know much about it, was there a champion from the project that like worked with you to get you over the hump or places that you were stuck? Or did you just have to kind of just figure it out on your own? Or did you ask questions on the Discourse channel or in a Slack channel or anything? How did that process go initially?
I think I definitely paced myself. I just picked up easier bugs whenever possible. And BYK and Mal, who maintain the project, would give guidance, especially through PR comments. And they'll also answer any questions on issues when, if I ask questions like, I'm not sure, you know, like what's the right approach here? Because sometimes like you get a bug and it's not just a bug. And it actually has to do with like philosophy of like, what should Yarn do in this case? There'd be like really minor edge cases, like maybe NPM does it in a particular way. Should Yarn respect that or should it try to be better? So those like discussions are, I think, really helpful and interesting, understanding like what's sort of going on.
It's fantastic when, you know, the conversation just kind of builds and you're learning stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you actually feel like you came out with the best solution or, you know, the best solution that you could, that was available to you at the end of the process.
You gain a lot of context about the project during those conversations.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. What was great about the selective resolution feature was that it was like completely like community driven, even from the RFC standpoint. It was submitted by someone in the community. And then it was implemented by me, who, you know, doesn't work at Facebook. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, so there'd been a lot of thought that was put into the feature just even before the implementation.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always so critical to getting people's actually saying like, hey, giving them some sort of specification, some sort of blueprint of what they're actually going to build. And, you know, one of the things also that I wanted to touch on, too, is you'd mentioned to us before the show that they have a very unique take on the way they handle communication with the community, not just in terms of pull requests, but also in terms of issues.
Yeah. So Yarn's issue count is around at 800.
Boy, that's and a lot. It's that can feel daunting when you look at that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's an actively developed project. A lot of people are passionate about it. And there are like bots that other projects use to just, you know, automatically close issues when they're not active. But something that BYK told me was when issues are closed, people take it somewhat personally. And, you know, we just want to make sure that there's like a human touch to it. And we at least get to the issues without just automatically closing them. And I really respect that. I think even when people are really frustrated, the maintainers like never really like lose their shit. They're always very graceful. And when someone is like acting, you know, outside of the standards of like code of conduct, there's sort of a gentle reminder. So far, like all of the interactions that I've seen through the issues have been, you know, really constructive rather than, you know, being like, sorry, like we're not going to work on this. It feels like it is a community project and people care about how it's being used. And it's like, it's definitely not easy given like all the different operating systems that Yarn has to accommodate. And, you know, it's like a pretty low level tool. So I give the guys a lot of kudos for handling that.
Yeah. Is there just even being able, I mean, 800 issues means that with a human touch, that means 800 people have to actually like, you know, respond to those issues. And usually those 800 people are not actually 800 people. They're like 10 people. Mm-hmm. and, you know, or some number significantly below 800. Like, how do you attack them to try and make sure that they're responded to like in a timely fashion?
Yeah, actually, I think issue tracking is like the hardest part of open source. I think it's like in the order of issue tracking and then reviewing PRs and then submitting PRs. Cause like, you know, like writing code is writing code, but understanding other people's code is more difficult. and understanding other people's like issues and what the bug is actually is even more difficult. And you don't, you know, obviously have their exact dev environment. So sometimes it's hard to repro. I think we do a lot of things that, you know, a lot of other projects leverage, which is, you know, we label the issues. We define priority if it's actually impacting a lot of people or if it's like a critical bug, like you can't install a package, you know, versus maybe like a warning message that could be tweaked. And then we kept a board, like a GitHub board to track issues when we were heading for the 1.0 release. I'm not sure if we're still doing that, but that helped to a degree. And other people from the community, not just the maintainers, like jump in to try and help out an issue, which is probably like one of the best things. And then when we merge pull requests, we close the issues that have been referenced.
Yeah, it's really wonderful when that kind of thing happens. So I'm so curious like how to foster that, because I know that it's so disheartening when you're working on a project and you file an issue and maybe it doesn't even go answered for, you know, one day, 2 days or 2 weeks, or you submit a pull request and there's not even, no one's even commenting on it. It can be really disheartening and kind of make you call into question the viability of the product itself, or it's all can be disheartening, especially if like you see like a lot of activity elsewhere. And you're like, yeah, but hello. Yeah. On the one hand, I also understand that like the maintainers are human and they probably have a lot of obligations. So I know that I've got a lot of projects where I let the issues languish, and I even have one where it's like, this is not one of my projects, but you know, one that I'm using where, yeah, I can't get any response, and it's just so frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, even like Yarn's definitely not perfect. Like there are definitely issues that just sort of go buried. You could add us at like yarn package/core. That pings all of us. And like the core team, you could call out specific people, but yeah, that's like a tough one.
Yeah, no, this isn't with Yarn, by the way. It's a totally separate project. But yeah, no, it's fantastic when there's that just kind of basic acknowledgement. Right. Makes such a difference, you know, in people's perception of the entire enterprise. It looks like we're actually approaching time. So if we want to give a special shout out to any talks you're going to be giving, any events that you'll be at, or
actually, Ben on my front-end platform team is speaking at Nodevember about Next React. So I think that's worth a shout-out.
Yeah.
Oh, and then Christoph will be speaking at AgentConf in Austria, I think in January, about the future of DevTools. So I think both things are worth going.
All right. Well, fantastic. Yep.
Any slick future features coming out in Yarn that we should know about?
I'll keep you updated.
All right. She's sworn to secrecy.
Right?
Yeah. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to
do
yet.
it was worth a try.
I could hear the pause of conspiracy in your voice. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kaylee, for coming on the show. This has been a really wonderful conversation that's just gone all over the map, and those are my favorite kind. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun, guys.
All right. Well, if people want to get in touch with you, how would they go about doing that?
I'm a rarity where I don't have Twitter, so you could email me, I guess. Yeah. Email
you. File an issue on Yarn.
Yeah, I'm Kaylee EB on GitHub and KayleeKwan@gmail.com.
And as always, you can get in touch with us. We're at The Front Side on Twitter, or just drop us a line on email. We use that on occasion too. Contact @frontside.io.
Perfect.
Thank you, Kaylee. Thank you, Ulrich. And thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, for listening.